Thank you, everybody, for being here. Rob, is there anybody that's actually on Zoom? Is there?
Yeah, there's one.
Okay. Well, thank you also for the person on Zoom for watching. Feel free to interrupt and ask questions, everybody. As Rob alluded to, what I'm going to talk about today is sort of work that came out of trying to generalize some recent work of mine on the quantum marginal problem. So if you haven't heard of that, it doesn't really matter. It'll be conceptualized as a sub-problem within this general framework. But the basic title of the talk sort of communicates what I'm going to speak about. So it's asymptotic realizability of properties of quantum states. So I hope, at the very least, people know what quantum states are. So at the very least, I'll be mainly talking about pure states and perhaps just more general, pure or mixed states, so density operators. And that's about the extent to which I'm thinking about quantum states. Of course, you can go further. The next thing is properties. So I think in a lot of circles, the concept of a property of a quantum state is just conceptualized as some kind of observable. In fact, that's sort of the idea of what a quantum theory is. It is some sort of mathematical device that tells you about the relationships between, let's say, the observables of interest, and maybe there's some algebraic structure on those observables. But for me, properties are probably much more general. I'm going to be conceptualizing properties as just any old functions, or rather suitably well-behaved functions, but certainly things that go beyond the standard notion of observables, in particular things like polynomials of your quantum state I'd consider to be properties, as well as things like entropies, which may or may not be linear or polynomial. The next bit is the realizability idea. So it comes without surprise, perhaps, that not all properties of a quantum state can be simultaneously realized. There are certain intrinsic constraints between the various properties of a quantum system. That's sort of the whole idea of the theory. And realizability or feasibility or satisfiability or compatibility, all these words just refer to this idea of, well, once you have some understanding of what your properties of your system are, now you need to understand what are the relationships between those properties. And that kind of question is generally quite challenging. Sometimes it's straightforward if your properties are suitably simple to work with. But in general, this idea of deciding relationships between properties is quite laborious. And so the purpose of this talk is to sort of allude to the fact that there is some machinery that can help you to tease out what those relationships are that is sort of asymptotic in character. You can get sort of finer and finer understanding of these relationships. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Does anybody have any questions about what I just said? Okay. All right. So the content of this, a lot of the details in how you formalize some of these ideas can get quite abstract, like the idea of what exactly is a property space. Like, you know, there's a lot of different mathematical things that can serve as labels for properties. And also thinking about like how you quantify the volume of states with particular properties can get quite abstract. So to stay sane, I'm going to be introducing some of these abstract ideas, but always referring back to a concrete example. And this is an example that I hope is reasonably familiar. It's to the point that nothing I say about the concrete example will be surprising. So this concrete example I'm going to be talking about is thinking about, well, suppose you're interested in just two observables, and rather just two expectation values. One is, I'm interested in pure qubit states, so just the surface of the Bloch sphere. And suppose I'm just interested in two expectation values, the one associated with poly X operator and the other one with poly Z operator. And so a natural kind of question you might ask is which pairs of property values, X and Z, can be realized as the expectation values of some pure state. And so you might already be able to see through the shaded out diagram that the answer is pretty straightforward. If you have some geometric idea of this space of states as the surface of a sphere, and the idea of the coordinates of this embedding of the sphere relating to these expectation values, you can see that this sort of region of possible values for X and Z that can be the expectation values of some quantum state just correspond to this unit disk, which can be thought of as the projection of the block sphere. So that shouldn't be too surprising. Another way to think about this is to take your property value assignments like x and z and ask, well, what are the fibers? What are all those states with those particular property values individually? And then this question of, you know, realizability just corresponds to whether or not those fibers sort of intersect. So here is three sort of examples. The first is the case where, you know, your candidate x and z values are too large, and so the sort of fibers of these two property values don't intersect. And so for this reason, there is no quantum state with those expectation values. And you can see as you vary these x and z values, whether or not these fibers intersect sort of characterize this unit disk. And so another answer to this question about realizability is just to say that property values are jointly realizable if and only if the sort of fibers intersect. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What is a fiber?
So fiber is just a fancy word to say, so the top line of this slide here. So recall f of x is just the function that takes a quantum state. There's a typo there in the blue, but so f of x is just the function that takes a pure quantum state to its expectation value with respect to poly z. And then the inverse is just given an expectation value little x, what are all the quantum states whose expectation value is little x? So it's sort of the inverse map.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The word fiber is usually reserved to talk about the sort of inverse of a particular point. So in this picture, this blue slice, or rather this circle that lives on the block sphere is just all of those pure states whose x expectation value is 3/4. And yeah, and there's a typo there, but that's no problem. Okay, should be fairly straightforward. Another way to think about this question of realizability is not just whether or not such a state exists, but suppose you want to know something more, like, you know, how many, you know, if some property values can be realized, well, how many states or what proportion of states, you know, produce expectation values in a given region. So the answer to that question is to, well, first you have to have some measure over the space of states you're talking about. And once you have that, you can calculate the sort of induced measure over the space of properties you're interested in. And in this case, you can imagine sort of a uniform distribution on the surface of the block sphere, and then sort of do that projection weighted relative to that measure, and you'll get some plot that looks like this. So you can see that outside this unit disk, the probability is zero, but sort of inside the disk, the probability is non-zero. And just by the geometry of the situation, the sort of boundary of this space happens to be larger in probability. You can actually compute these probability densities directly. And so in this case, you see that outside the unit disk, the density has a probability density is zero, which is just to say that these values are unrealizable. But inside, you have this sort of non-zero measure. And there's some singularity on the boundary that you don't have to worry about.
Sorry, was this given for a particular expectation of fx and fz?
So this is the, as a function of x and z, right? So another way to say it is, suppose I'm interested in the set of x and z expectation values that live in this region here. The volume of this region relative to this probability density tells you the likelihood that a random state would have those expectation values. So this is sort of goes beyond this idea of this binary idea of whether or not a state exists or not with the certain properties, but gives you some sort of quantitative idea about, well, how many states maybe have those properties. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a sort of discontinuity, I mean to say, which is, you know, right on the boundary. Well, to be clear, the boundary of the unit disk has measure zero, so it doesn't really matter what you say the probability density is in that region. But the idea is that as you move towards the boundary, the probability of a random state having those expectation values actually goes up compared to sort of the bulk. And that just has to do with the fact that when you take sort of the sort of inverse projection back onto the block sphere, these property values in some sense extrude out to some tangents of the sphere. And that's why these things go up, whereas in the bulk it's much lower.
that.
But the point is, as you cross this boundary, it goes diverges to infinity and then drops back down to zero.
One more question, sorry. What's the definition of the push forward? Is that the same as the definition of the probability density, or is it a coincidence that they happen to be the same thing?
So the definition of the push forward is just, it is, well, it just says the probability you would assign to any given region is precisely just the, you take that region, you look at its inverse through f of x and f of z, which is you just take what are all the states whose x and z expectation values land in that region, and then ask what's the volume of that set of states relative to this measure mu. And that's what this push-forward measure is here. But this statement here is, so you can define the push-forward measure, but then it's a whole other story about how you calculate maybe what it is, what its probability density is, let's say. Or rather, just compute the measure is a whole different story.
But I thought you said the probability measure is already measuring, sorry, the push-forward is already measuring the, like the volume of states with respect to mu. So doesn't that already give you a probability?
Yeah, no, so it does. What I mean to say is that if what you're interested in is a more quantitative question about realizability, then the answer to that question is to go and compute this push-forward measure. That answers this question about, you know, what proportion of states has these properties. But then the task of actually calculating what that measure is, on one hand you can define it, but then there's another business of computing what the inverse map is that's in some sense the task of solving this problem in the first place. So you can sort of define the thing that you want to look for, but then there's a whole other story of how you calculate them.
So basically the reference from mm-hmm. is calculating the push forward measure.
That's right.
It's like a
that's
calculation
right.
result. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. And in fact that this whole talk is all about it's about a couple things, but in general, the calculating these measures is quite challenging. And so I'm sort of going to give you some schema by which you can approximate it. Okay, so that was sort of the concrete example where you have some well-defined set of, a familiar set of quantum states and some maybe familiar properties and the kinds of questions you might ask about realizability or quantitative realizability. Now I'm going to sort of introduce a sort of more general framework that explains what I'm talking about maybe in more detail. So in general, when I think of a property or I speak about a property, I'm imagining just in general just some function. It's got to be a measurable function in order to do calculations with it. But ultimately, on one side, S is just the set of states you might be interested in. It could be the set of all states or some pure states, or it doesn't really matter. And then X is just some space of property values. And the property is just this, you know, assignment map. And for some technical reasons that, you know, often go overlooked, this property space has to be sufficiently well behaved in order to speak about, you know, assigning nice measures and doing calculations in a reasonable way. So I'm taking a very abstract view of what a property could be. So this includes things like observables, as we'll see. So here's a big list of examples of properties I might be thinking about. So the familiar one might just be, you give some observable, the expectation value is some real number valued property of any given quantum state. You can also think of probabilities that a state would assign to events as properties of that state. You can think of things like von Neumann entropies of a quantum state as a kind of property. You can also think of like the marginals of, or the reduced states of some many body quantum system as properties of that quantum system. Also things like eigenvalues of the matrix. You can also think of these moment maps, which sort of relate how a quantum state changes infinitesimally when you act on it with a sort of non-compact group, sort of tell you the scaling properties of your state. And so here the property isn't some number or collection of numbers, but it's some family of maps. You can also think of just sort of nonlinear polynomials, like for example, the purity. As a sort of degree two polynomial in your state as a property. Or you can think of just the whole state as a property. This identity map just tells you that the entire state can be thought of as a property of itself. And I imagine you can go on and on and on and list as many properties you might be interested in. But the sort of abstract way of thinking about properties allows you to sort of conceptualize you know, some sort of category of compositional ideas involving properties. So for example, if you have some property F and some other map G that takes you from X to some other space Y, then you can compose those maps together and get a new property that just takes on values in Y. Another thing you can do is if you have, say, two different properties, X and G, take on values in different spaces, you can look at their product, which is just to say that you conceptualize two properties as one. And you can do the same thing in reverse if your property sort of has some Cartesian space. But the big takeaway here is just to say that there isn't really a meaningful distinction at this abstract level between a single property and a collection of properties. So you might say like, oh, this set of observables are the properties in my state, but you can just say, oh, I can just bundle all those together and think of that as one property. You can do the same thing in reverse. So if you say, the real value associated with this observable expectation value is a property, well, you can break that into pieces and you can say, oh, the second decimal place or the third decimal place of this expectation value is also a property. So there isn't really a meaningful distinction at this level between a collection of properties or a single property. And this level of abstraction is really helpful. Once you have fix a property, let's call that F, you can talk about the realizable region, which is just the set of values in X that can be realized by some quantum state. And the realizability problem then is to say, okay, given a property or collection of properties, which is sort of the same thing, you can ask, well, what is the subset of X that is realizable? And so the sort of realizability problem for any given property is just to maybe decide or characterize this boundary or decide whether or not a point is inside or outside. And as I've sort of alluded to before, points inside this space I'll call realizable and points outside will be unrealizable. Okay. So there's a lot of things that you run into in quantum information theory at the very least, and in quantum foundations perhaps, that can be thought of as realizability problems. So perhaps the most obvious one is some kind of uncertainty relation. So this stipulates something that holds true for all states for any given observables A and B. And you can think of this as a kind of necessary condition for the realizability of this triple of properties. First is the variance of observable A, the second is the variance of observable B, and the third is sort of this absolute value of the expectation of the commutator of those two. And so you can think of this uncertainty relation as just some necessary condition that carves out this subset of three-dimensional real space of realizable values for those properties. The recent work I did was on the quantum marginal problem, which is just the realizability problem for the given reduced state. So if you have some Hilbert space that has some tensor product structure, you can ask, well, what are the possible realizable values for the reduced states of a given quantum system? There's some other questions like, okay, what are the relationships between entropies? This is the idea of entropic inequalities. There's a lot of open problems there, but for example, the strong subadditivity of von Neumann entropy can be thought of as a necessary condition for the realizability of different entropies of different subsystems. More abstract one might be to say, okay, I've got some group that's acting on my space of states, and I want to characterize the sort of orbits of that space in a sort of invariant way. One thing you can do is sort of figure out which coordinates or which functions or which properties of your state don't change under the action of that group. But then there's a whole other problem of asking, okay, now what are the relationships between those invariants? And so that can be thought of, the characterizing of this sort of relationship between invariants is also a realizability problem. You also run into these when you think about resource theories, or at least sometimes you do. So if you have some resource theory involving operations and there's some way of decomposing those operations into pieces, you can sort of cast questions about interconversion between states in that resource theory as a kind of realizability problem. So there's a lot of different things that you can think of as realizability problems. So how do you actually solve them, or how do you decide this question? So it turns out there's a lot of different things you can do, and depending on which set of properties you're interested in, you might want to use different methods. So one very general class of realizability problems that receives a lot of attention is the idea of, well, if you're interested in quantum states as all the mixed states, or not necessarily pure states, I mean to say, but just all the density operators on some Hilbert space, and you're interested in just some property or collection of properties, which is the same thing, as just a set of linear functions, then you can cast this as some sort of, you can solve this in terms of some semi-definite program. But this is, from my point of view, a little bit restrictive because you're not always interested in necessarily the full set of density matrices, and you're also not necessarily always interested in linear properties. So another thing you can do, which is quite abstract, is just to say, well, if you have some set of properties that are all just polynomial or algebraic in character, then in principle you can cast this as some sort of problem in computational algebraic geometry that is very well understood, but it turns out the algorithms for actually solving these kinds of questions are outrageously inefficient to the point that they're very, very poorly, or very infrequently used. And so the point of this talk is to think from the perspective of, at a very abstract level, properties of quantum states aren't necessarily, well, there's this analytic idea of what a property is, which is just as some function of quantum states. But in practice, a lot of the properties I mentioned can be estimated empirically by interacting with, say, your quantum system and taking measurements. So the idea here is to discuss how you can think about estimating properties and then think about estimating relationships between properties. Okay. So now we need to talk a little bit about property estimation theory.
So you're not concerned at all about tomography, just whether, like, given enough properties, you can reconstruct the state. You just want to know if it's possible.
Yeah, so it's a good question. What I'm about to talk about is something that works for any collection of properties or property you're interested in. So maybe you're entirely interested in this set of observables and the relationships between them. Or maybe you're interested in the entropies of the system or the entanglement properties of the system. Or if you have some subset of properties you care about, then you might as well just study the relationships between those properties. It can be the case that maybe you're interested in reconstructing the whole state. You're interested in the subject of quantum state tomography. That's sort of contained as a special case where the property you're interested in is just the identity map, the map that takes any given quantum state to itself. And then the way in which you do quantum tomography or quantum state tomography is just a special case of quantum property tomography, which is sort of what I'm going to talk about next, or at least a sort of sophisticated way of thinking about that. So here's the idea of property estimation theory. But I think to make sure we're on the same page, I'm going to go back to this concrete example where I think you might already have some idea about what you would do. So suppose you're interested in estimating the expectation value of some pure quantum state with respect to the Pauli X observable. It's not too hard to see that the idea is that you just make a projective measurement in the eigenbasis of Pauli X operator and then just collect all the empirical frequencies of different outcomes and let that be a proxy for the expectation value. That's sort of baked into the idea of what an expectation value is. It's the result of some infinite process of measurements, and this is sort of the limiting value you would get. So one way you can define it is just to say, suppose I prepare my state independently and identically many times, let's say n times. I can identify the sort of subspace of this tensor power space that would produce a expectation value of x little hat, or an empirical expectation of x value of little x. And then you can define a sort of estimation scheme, which is just some sequence of measurements you do indexed by n, that produces as its outcomes these sort of approximate values or expected values, little x. So the idea here would be that Ex sub n is a sequence of, in this case, projective value measures that have elements that are indexed by the empirical estimates themselves. And so the idea is, this is what you would write down. If you were to prepare some quantum state n times and perform this measurement, then the probability of getting an estimate x hat that lives in some region of this interval between negative 1 and 1 is given by this formula, the Born rule. Yeah?
I'm sorry, can you explain again what is this set V and x?
Yeah, so this is just a very slick way of writing down for any given x bar, okay, or x hat is going to be the estimate for the expectation value of sigma x, okay? And Basically, one way, the idea is that the way you obtain that estimate is on each instance of psi, you perform some projective measurement in the eigenbasis of sigma x, and you record its outcome. But then the idea is you have to sum over all of the different ways, or all the different sequences of outcomes that contribute to the same value of x hat, in the sense of there are many different sequences of outcomes that will all lead you to produce an estimate of x hat for the expectation value of sigma x for psi.
For finite n, x hat is a rational,
That's right, yeah. So this subspace is only non-empty for certain values of x hat.
Right.
But the idea is that this is a very slick way of just saying, well, think about the vectors, or think about the subspace of vectors whose live inside the subspace projected onto all those sequences of measurements which produce x hat as an estimate.
So the possible values of x hat are just all the possible relative frequencies. I could have got all n plus 1, or n minus 1 plus 1, and 1 minus 1, and so on, and that's the different subspaces.
Yeah.
For given n.
Yeah. So to maybe just be more concrete, when you do this kind of measurement scheme, at the end of the day, the distribution describing your estimates, because there's only essentially two outcomes, there's two eigenvalues for sigma x, is given by some binomial distribution of the following form. And so that's what we get. So you can abstract away this process of producing estimates for the expectation value into some sort of scheme of making some sort of global measurements that act on n copies of your initial space. Okay, so once you have some scheme for, let's say, estimating the expectation value for sigma x, you can do the same thing to estimate both sigma x and or the expectation value for sigma x and the expectation value for sigma z. And one simple strategy for doing that is just to prepare your state 2n times and then just do the sort of estimation scheme for sigma x on the first n instances of your state and do the same thing for sigma z on the second n instances of your state. And you obtain some joint distribution for producing x estimates x hat and z hat in this region. And so what you can do is sort of view this distribution of estimates. So here's an example where, suppose I have a state whose expectation values are 1 over root 2 and 1 over root 2 for x and z. And you can ask, as a function of n, how are the estimates for those values distributed? And you get something like this. So you can see that, you know, if you prepare your state 10 times and do reserve 5 of those instances to estimate x and 5 for estimate z, this would be your distribution of estimates. And as you increase n, your estimates sort of get closer and closer to the sort of true values that correspond to this state here. So this probably shouldn't be too surprising, but this is sort of motivating the general framework.
Could you just go back one or two slides? Didn't have enough time to process the definition of the estimate.
So I can elaborate on the way this is formulated.
Yes, please.
So an estimation scheme, well, there'll be a slide that talks about the general case, but in this case, we're estimating the expectation value f of x of psi, but it's indexed by n, where n just tells you how many copies of the state you prepare before you do your measurement or, when you do your measurement. And so the idea is that this map will assign to intervals of the sort of realizable region for this expectation value from negative 1 to plus 1. It assigns for you an effect that acts on this large Hilbert space. The specific way it does that is this. It's just a sum over all the projectors associated with estimates x hat that live in this region. And this is sort of a unified way of thinking about the measurement schemes which produce estimates for this property you care about in a sort of uniform way as you increase n.
So every sequence gets a PLU.
rather there's a different POVM for each n. So so if you were to, yeah, that's what I mean to say. Maybe we return to the...
Sorry, yeah. So you start with some... Sorry, what's sigma of, capital sigma of minus one and plus one?
This here?
Yeah.
So this is the, it's the set of all interval, it's the set of all subsets, let's say, of the interval between negative one and plus one, okay? So for example, delta might be the, say, interval between maybe zero and a half. And then what this operator is doing for you is saying, well, what would the projective element be corresponding to an outcome of this measurement giving you an estimate between zero and a half? So deltas in this case are just these, you can think of just as intervals in this region.
And for finite n, you're only going to ever estimate an expectation value k over n for some k, or well, not quite, but so you're just looking for all those rational values, the expectation value in the interval delta, and summing those up.
Yeah.
And what about theta?
So theta here is this theta?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you can ignore that. That's not pertinent for this estimation scheme. This is just a slick way of saying that the subspaces that produce those estimates are just common eigenspaces of this representation of U1 generated by sigma x. This is just a slick way of describing. So in other words, let me just write it on the chalkboard here. Suppose I prepare my state once. There's only really two estimates that you would ever obtain. Either you estimate plus one or minus one. And in this case, the corresponding projection operator is just the plus and minus states. Okay. But if you prepare your state twice, right, there's three possible estimates you can get. Namely, plus one, which is in the case that you get the plus outcome twice. And similarly, you can get minus one as an estimate. That's if you get the minus outcome twice. But you can also get zero as your estimate, which is if you get, say, one of the outcomes being plus, the other one being minus. And I'm going to go behind this board here, but it's...
Yeah, fine. Yeah. I see.
Yeah, I'm hiding away all this mess in this way. And similarly for three, there's four possible estimates in five and six. But the point is, x always lives in your estimate, this second subscript, always lives in this interval. And so you can sort of, in a uniform way, talk about all of these different projective measurement schemes where n is some sort of parametric variable that you sort of study. This is a very slick way of just sort of encapsulating that all into sort of a common notation.
So this is the real thing, and this is the you've packaged it into a nice mathematical form.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're doing it in a less slick way, pedestrian way, you just say, oh, B is the projector of all products of x up and x down states where, you know, k are up and n minus k are down,
yes,
all permutations, and that will give me an estimate k over n minus. That's what those projections look like.
Yeah, that's a bit easier to understand. But seeing this, it's, of course, it's nice.
Yeah. This is really what I should have made a little bit more easier to understand. The idea is that there's a very big trouble that comes when you try and think about estimation theory, which is that oftentimes the empirical process of producing estimates, whether they be for expectation values or some more elaborate property, they only take on discrete values in the space. Right? And it's only in this in the asymptotic limit that you get this continuum of possible estimates. And so in some sense, like, the only way you ever obtain an expectation value that isn't a rational number is in the limit, in some sense. This is just one way of sort of hiding away all that discrete stuff and sort of make it seem prematurely continuous. Okay. So this slide is just to say that if you have some way of estimating property fx and another way of estimating property fz, then you can estimate them together by just, you know, preparing more copies of your state and doing estimates independently. And in doing so, you'll converge onto, in an unsurprising way, the true values, let's say, of your properties. Okay, so we sort of saw an example. This would be the general conceptualization of a property that I'm taking from this paper on quantum state tomography or quantum state estimation by Kiel. So the idea is, suppose you have some property, which again is just some generic function. So if you have some sequence of, in general, some POVMs, where this sequence is indexed by n, and it assigns to regions of your property space x some effect on n copies of your underlying Hilbert space, you can say that this sequence of measurement schemes, a sequence of POVMs indexed by n, forms an f estimation scheme. It's some scheme that estimates property f. If it's the case that for every given state that you're performing this measurement on, you find that this measure here, which tells you the sort of probability of producing an estimate in some interval dx, converges to the Dirac measure, which is to say that it converges to the deterministic assignment of the actual property of your state, f of rho. So all this to say is that you have some sort of convergence to the mean or convergence to the expected value, and this business about appealing to general functions, g, is just to acknowledge the fact that, well, your property space might not be real numbers. They could just be any abstract space in principle. In order to make sense of the convergence of these quantities as real numbers, let's say, you have to map everything back to real numbers. But in principle, this is just saying that the empirical measure converges weakly to the Dirac measure. In other words, if you go back to the previous slide, it's just saying that the sequence of measures converges to a point corresponding to the true property value. And that's true for each state.
Is there a notion of unbiasedness? You know, that estimators are biased or unbiased and so on?
Yes. This would be a condition that just says these estimators are unbiased, I think. But I've come across different considerations for the notion of bias and unbiased estimators. Sometimes they mean some sort of uniformity with respect to errors. Sometimes they just mean convergence to the mean. Basically what this is just saying is that no matter what state you're working with, in the limit as n goes to infinity, the value you're going to get is the value of the property. Okay, so what are some examples? We saw one, which is how do you estimate an expectation value. It turns out you can construct estimation schemes for pretty much every property, and they get more and more complicated, but ultimately the framework is sufficiently general to accommodate all these different properties. So here's the simplest one, I would say. You can consider this Boolean property, which is whether or not the state is a particular state. Let's call that phi. So a state either is or is not phi. And one way you can estimate whether or not your state is phi is just to do this sequence of projective measurements, where on one hand you project onto n tensor copies of phi, and the other is the complement. And so for this estimation scheme, this really does, the only way that you asymptotically always get yes is if your state really is phi. By similar constructions, you can do other things like how do you estimate whether or not your state is pure? Well, that's similar. Basically, you just, again, do some binary measurement because there's only two values of the property, yes or no. And the projective element associated with yes for each n is just the symmetric subspace, which is just to say that the only way in which your state is pure is if n tensor powers of that state always remain in the symmetric subspace. We saw an example of, well, how do you estimate the expectation value? It's you just do a projective measurement onto the eigenspace of your observable and just sum over all the configurations that lead to that estimate. You can estimate spectra. In this case, the I'm not going to sort of explain this in detail, but the estimation scheme that gives you an estimate for the spectra is generated by these sort of isotypic components in the Schurweil decomposition of many copies of your Hilbert space, which is just to say that there's some well-defined way of carving up your Hilbert space into sort of equal types, where these lambdas are just Young diagrams, and asymptotically they converge to your spectra. You can do the same thing for quantum state tomography, which is, you know, how do you estimate the whole state? Well, it's a sort of generalization of this idea, but instead of projecting onto the, you know, it's a little bit more complicated, but the idea is the same. For each n, you have some POVM, and the outcomes of that POVM are descriptions of your state. In this case, it's sort of split into two pieces. One is the eigenvectors, and one is the eigenvalues. But nevertheless, you do this. The insight that helped me make some progress on the quantum marginal problem was just to realize that, well, if you have some scheme for estimating the whole state, then you also have some scheme for estimating a reduced state. You just apply this, these projective measurements only on a subset of your system, or subsystem. In general, if you have any kind of continuous function of your quantum state, you can take some estimation scheme like this and produce an estimation scheme for that continuous function. So in a certain sense, a great deal of properties can be estimated in this way. And I've yet to come across a kind of property that people talk about in quantum theory that doesn't always come with some scheme for estimating that value. In some sense, you might take this as some sort of principle about, well, what actually is a property other than some abstract function? Well, it's got to be something that can in principle be estimated. Otherwise, we wouldn't invent the concept in the first place. The next idea is thinking about how do you estimate many properties together. Okay, so suppose you have some estimation scheme that gives you an estimate for F, and some other scheme that gives you an estimate for G. If those two measurement schemes, they're commuting for all sort of elements, then you can easily construct some joint estimation scheme. This is just saying if you have commuting observables, then you can measure them jointly. But what's interesting is the sort of non-commuting case, which is something we saw earlier. In principle, if the measurement schemes are non-commuting, then you, the best idea I have for jointly estimating those properties is just to reserve some portion of your many states for estimating property F, and then some other portion for estimating property G. And if you do it this way, you also get some estimation scheme. But I have an open question, which is like whether or not there's some better way of estimating non-commutative properties, let's say, without sort of doing things in a blockwise fashion. It seems like there could be, but it's hard to come up with the idea.
TC, yeah. Your example of commuting.
Yeah.
Quite parse it. Is the idea that you actually measure the basis that diagonalizes both, and then you use, you coarse grain that to get your estimates? Is that?
Yes. That's one way of putting it. In fact, you don't really need to do any coarse graining. If you're talking about a region of the joint property space that is a rectangle, which is to say it's the product of some region of properties for X, some region of the property space for X and some region of the property space for Y, then all I'm saying is that you can just apply the measurement scheme that is corresponds to the common diagonalization of both those elements. There's sort of, this is just the anti-commutator. You just say, you know, take F times G, because they commute, and so that it'll remain a effect.
That's what I was missing. I thought that was the set F and G.
No, I meant to.
That's the product of F and G.
I could have just said the product of F and G, because they commute, and so it doesn't matter. Okay. All right, so I started this talk thinking about, what time is it? Okay, not gonna have enough time. So I started this talk thinking about realizability problems, which is like, you know, which properties can be achieved. And then I introduced some formalism for thinking about how do you estimate properties. So we got to combine them together. The quickest way to combine them together is in this realm of this quantitative realizability, this idea of asking, well, what proportion of states has a given set of properties? So in order to do that, you can apply this here, you get the following idea. So suppose I have some measure over the space of states I'm interested in, call that mu. Maybe it's some Haar measure, or maybe it's something else. You can talk about, well, what's the so-called mu Diffinetti state? So this is a state that is, well, I have some uncertainty about what state I'm working with. That uncertainty is sort of characterized by this probability measure mu. But what I do know is that state was prepared n times independently and identically. And you can think of this as one large quantum state that acts on n tensor copies of your Hilbert space. And so here's the idea, that if you have some estimation scheme for property F, then in the asymptotic limit, you get the sort of empirical distribution when you apply the estimation scheme to a Diffinetti state will converge to this push-forward measure, which is to say that, well, let's go to the example so you can understand what I'm saying. On the next slide, so let's apply that result to this familiar example of poly X and Z. So here I'm going to just have half the n copies of my state be used to estimate X and the same for Y. So I got this joint estimation scheme over X and Z. And let's just assume we have some uniform measure over the surface of the block sphere. So that the Diffinetti state is just the uniform state on maximally mixed state on the symmetric subspace.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Mu is like your the agent's like epistemic uncertainty with the data. So if it's a measure, they have absolutely no clue what state.
Yeah, so for example, if you're an agent that knows the state is pure, know it was prepared n times independently and identically, but have no clue which state it is, then this would be the quantum state describing your knowledge about those n systems. It's equivalent to, or you know, inferentially equivalent to the mixed state on the symmetric subspace. But so here's the idea. Suppose I'm performing this joint estimation scheme for X and Z on the this Diffinetti state, this uniform state, I can ask what are the expected estimates for each n, and you can get some plot like this. So the idea is that if you were to, in this case, prepare your state n times, or 10 times, and get an estimate for x and z, this is what you would expect if you have no knowledge about what the initial state was. And as you crank up the value of n, you can see that you're slowly converging to that sort of plot of the push-forward measure that I showed at the beginning, where on the outside you have some very low probability, and on the sort of bulk, things sort of look like the projection of the uniform measure on a sphere. So that's this idea that as n gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you converge to this push-forward measure. That's what this result's saying. But this tells you how to asymptotically approximate this sort of quantitative idea of realizability, this push-forward measure. But there's a crucial question here that I think is very difficult to appropriately deal with, which is, suppose I'm not interested in the question of quantitative realizability, which I'm not interested in what proportion of states, I just want to know whether or not such a state exists. Okay. So this scheme, it seems like, doesn't give you the tools to answer that question. And the reason is simply that if, for example, I prepared some, or I say sampled some state uniformly with respect to this measure, and I prepared it n times independently and identically, and then I did some estimates for poly X and poly Z, there is always a finite probability that you produce as estimates jointly plus one for the expectation value of sigma X and plus one for the expectation value of sigma Z, which is to say the probability associated with this sort of top right corner always is non-zero. You could, in principle, you could always be fooled into thinking that there is a quantum state that has those properties just by getting unlucky, let's say. There's always a finite probability for that to occur. And so in a certain way, it's hard to distinguish between those estimates that are just outliers and those estimates which, in some say, are not betraying the idea, that there really could be a state that has those expectation values. And so the question is, well, how do you distinguish, say, between the outside of this region and the inside? Well, there's a lot of different strategies for that, but you might, one simple thing to say, well, is maybe there's some threshold where you say, I'm gonna have some error epsilon and everything that has a probability below epsilon, I'm gonna consider to be sort of approximately unrealizable, and everything above epsilon will be considered approximately realizable. The challenge with that is you have to scale epsilon with n now, because the probabilities for any point always go to zero in the limit as n goes to infinity. So you have to come up with some other way of differentiating between this sort of unrealizable region and the realizable region. And the way you do that is something I'm probably not gonna have time to fully explore, but it involves thinking about the rates of the probabilities assigned to regions outside or inside. And it turns out the right distinction, as far as I'm concerned, is if you have some region inside the realizable region, you'll find that the decay of those probabilities as n goes to infinity is far slower than those on the outside, which is to say that the actual probability of getting fooled into thinking, the actual probability of getting a plus one estimate for the doubly plus one estimates for sigma x and sigma z, that's going to decay to zero at a rate that's exponential in n, which is in sharp contrast to those estimates that really do live inside the realizable region, which do decay to zero as n goes to infinity, but not at an exponential rate. They're lower bounded by some polynomial function, or one over some polynomial function. And so the rest of this talk was going to be about, sort of what is the mathematical formalism for distinguishing between exponential decay of probabilities and polynomial decay of probabilities.
Why do you say, like, if I took a finite interval in the unrealizable region, mm-hmm. that probability really goes to zero, but a finite interval inside, its probability should go to some finite value, not to zero.
That's true, but that'll allow you to, so that is very true. Sorry, I was misleading in that respect. So if all you're interested in is realizability of regions, then you can make this distinction. Yeah, it goes to zero or is, yeah.
They both go to zero,
yeah.
But it's the rate that can tell them apart.
That's right.
And is there a reason to be focused on the points rather than the regions?
No, it's just, if that is sufficient for, your interest, then you don't need any further formalism. You can just say, compute this, and as n gets bigger and bigger, you get a better and better understanding of whether or not that region contains any realizable property values or not. Ultimately, I'm also interested in the question of how do you reason about individual singleton points? How do you carve out the boundary of this space, which is going to always remain fuzzy?
Right.
That's very challenging, but it's doable. Or at least,
that's a good answer. If you're just in the boundary, you really can't get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. You, in some sense, you really do want to be able to speak about a single point.
Yeah.
And ask, does there exist a state that can realize these individual property values?
If you're just outside the boundary or just inside,
yeah,
you want to say, what's the difference?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I can get into this, but it seems like I've already spent an hour. But this subject of sequences of probabilities of very rare or outlying events that decay exponentially is the subject of large deviation theory. The idea being that if you have some statistical process, large deviations away from what you would expect tend to have probabilities that decay to zero very quickly at an exponential rate. And in principle, large deviation theory is concerned with characterizing what those rates are. If you're interested in learning about this subject, there's sort of two ways you can do it. One is from a physicist's point of view, and the other one's from a mathematical point of view. These are the references that I came across. But the whole idea is that you can characterize these measures which have some exponential rate using these ideas of, Laplace's method of steepest descent. So the idea being that if you're integrating, in this case, some finite region, some compact region, and you have some exponential, some function h of x, then the values of this integrand that contribute the most to the integral are going to be those where h is maximized. And you can actually pick out those maxima by sort of appropriately scaling the exponential argument and then renormalizing things on the output and taking the right logarithm. And so this whole business of, or at least the Laplace principle approach to large deviation theory, is all about just generalizing these ideas. And so it turns out these are the definitions for what does it mean for, some sequence of probability measures to obey some Laplace principle, which means it's governed by some exponential decay characterized by a function I. And you can apply those ideas of large deviation theory to these empirical measures that you get when you apply these estimation schemes to quantum states. And in principle, or in practice, all of the estimation schemes I mentioned earlier in the talk are all of this form, that there really is a rate of decay that is exponential that characterizes the probabilities of large deviations. And there's some general theories about how you do this in general for any given collection of properties, at least those that relate to the interaction between quantum theory and representation theory. And so let's just talk about what that looks like in this special case of estimating the, say, x expectation value. So it turns out that this sequence of probability measures does satisfy this principle, and the rate function is a function like this. So here's what it looks like. As in an example, suppose your state has an expectation value of 1/5, so it's a little bit to the right of the Bloch sphere. What you'll find is that the actual distribution over your estimates for between -1 and 1 will sort of converge around the true values that you'd expect of 1/2. And the rate of decay of the probabilities for every other value is governed by this red function, which is your rate function, which is to say that the probabilities associated with these estimates as n goes to infinity decays at an exponential rate equal to this, the value of this red line here. The specific form of this rate function is just sort of the relative entropy of a binary distribution. So it has this particular form. But the key idea is that it's the further you move away from the true value, the greater the exponential decay. And so within this framework of thinking about exponential decay, you can develop some material that allows you to make precise statements about individual points. But you have to qualify some things. The first is the prior measure you use. In principle, it could be anything. But in order to make some concrete statements, it has to be that your measure has this property of inclusivity, which is just to say that the behavior of any individual state within the support of this measure is somehow represented in the average behavior of the Diffinetti state. And basically, all the measures you might pick are of this form. And there's an open problem of mine to figure out whether or not there is anything that doesn't have this inclusivity property. The next thing that enables you to talk about individual points, as opposed to just regions of your property space, is to scale the intervals that you're thinking about with n as well. So instead of just asking what is the probability of getting an estimate for a property in a region, you can ask what is the sequence of probabilities associated with getting estimates in a region that shrinks towards the point that you're talking about. And there's some ideas about shrinking these regions at a very critical rate that enables you to make statements like the following. So here's some sort of fundamental theorem that I'm developing with regards to characterizing realizable points. So you have some property you're interested in, you have some estimation scheme, and you have some prior measure that has this inclusivity property. Here's the idea that if you have a point in your property space that's unrealizable, then you'll find that as you zoom in on that point and ask what is the sequence of probabilities on average for those estimates, and you rescale things with respect to this inclusivity idea, you'll find that that sequence always converges to zero. On the other hand, if your property is unrealizable, then you'll find that there is a way in which you can zoom in on that point such that the sort of sequence of probabilities of this form remains far away from zero. It's sort of gapped away from zero. And so there's this way of strongly separating realizable and unrealizable points by sort of scaling things at just the right way. And behind the scenes, this is just saying that unrealizable points have probabilities that decay at an exponential rate versus realizable points correspond to probabilities that decay at a sub-exponential rate, or don't decay at all. Maybe they converge to one. But the idea is just that the intuition behind this result is sort of, I think, should be clear enough, which is that like a property value of a quantum state is realizable if and only if you occasionally get that estimate, get that value as an estimate of some random state. That is, well, if there is a state with these expectation values, then on occasion, I should be able to produce a random state that behaves as if it has those approximate values as expectation values. And sometimes you can actually explicitly construct these critical sequences or critical zooming in rates to make this a little bit less abstract, make it much more concrete. And so the conclusion is, there's a lot of things in quantum theory which you can think of as property realizability problems. The strategy I've been exploring is through these estimation schemes. And the sort of high level takeaway is hopefully intuitive that realizable property values, or property values are realizable if and only if they're occasionally estimated. And then there's some future work. Some of this is partially progressed, but there's a lot of future direct, there's a lot of interesting avenues you can explore to sort of develop these ideas further. So there you go, thank you. Sorry, I rushed through the last half, but hopefully it's sort of at a high level that last half was reasonably intuitive. I don't know.
Thanks for the talk. I think it's interesting. I've not often seen research on this sort of thing before in quantum theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's maybe not such a common thing. So it's really interesting to see something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I go back to the way back, to the slide that just lists examples of realizability problems. So I never really wanted to get interested in this in the first place. But I just kept finding that all the interesting questions at some level, I sort of ran into these last four at some point or another. And I realized, okay, it would be nice if there were some general tools for being able to answer these questions. And there are some general tools, but they're incredibly limited. They're very difficult to work with, but they're limited in the sense that it only works for linear properties, or it only works for, polynomial properties or something like that. So I was sort of interested in strategies for solving these problems in a more general context. And so that's why I sort of developed this new way of thinking, let's say.
Going back to the tomography thing, I know that's not quite, but I just thought it would be kind of interesting that if you had the preimage of some point on X and the preimage of some on X prime, you had a bunch of different property types, you'd still do tomography. Because usually you do tomography based on kind of the same X, I imagine.
What do you mean?
Regular tomography, I would have thought, you do a bunch of measurements, you do it in X, Y, Z, but those are all probability, a property type when X equals R.
I see.
I'm just curious if, you could do tomography without using the same type of property,
I see. Yeah, so there is a sort of growing body of ideas regarding this concept of shadow tomography, which is... the word is kind of misleading. Ultimately, it's this realization that, in a lot of contexts, you don't really need the whole state. There's a lot of unnecessary information in a large quantum state. And so in principle, if you have some quantities you care about, then you can just sort of do tomography for those properties, which is this idea of property estimation schemes. Now, to be clear, tomography is actually a lot of other things on top, which is tomography is usually conceptualized as a two-stage process where you do some measurements, and then based on the outcomes of those measurements, you do some post-processing to sort of reconstruct your state or your properties that you care about. And this sort of framework just sort of smushes those together and thinks of it as one process. So the thing you were mentioning is, let's say if you're doing tomography of a single qubit or of many qubits, it doesn't really matter, you can do this thing, polytomography. It's sort of the standard scheme by which you say, I'm going to do some measurements of sigma x, do some measurements of sigma y, do some measurements of sigma z, let those approximate values be these approximate coordinates of my blocks of my sphere or of my quantum state in the block ball or block sphere. And this sort of gives you a sort of standard tomography scheme. One of the perceived downsides, let's say, of that naive approach or of that approach, it's not really naive at all. One of the downsides is that sometimes you get estimates outside the block sphere, right? You kind of expect there to be, especially if you're thinking about pure states. And so that's usually conceptualized as a bug, let's say, that there's some outliers that you have to deal with. But I guess this approach is more about acknowledging that as a feature, which is to say that you can quantify the probability of getting an outlier and let that be a way of indirectly determining whether or not states have those properties or not. There is an infinite number of ways to do quantum state tomography. The concept of tomographic completeness is it doesn't uniquely pick out some strategy for reconstructing a state.
Any other questions, including the online audience?
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.